Morning is State of Minnesota versus No Gonzalez. We are ready for argument from appellant's counsel. Would you please introduce yourself for the record before beginning?
Certainly. Good afternoon. Andrew Wilson, WILSON, on behalf of Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, my name is Andrew Wilson. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Gonzalez. We're simply requesting the court reverse and remand for a new trial, given that the cumulative effect of numerous errors that occurred at trial served to deprive Mr. Gonzalez of his right to a fair trial. Happy to address those issues, but my prepared remarks focus primarily on the prosecutorial misconduct that occurred during opening statements, during direct examination of the majority of state witnesses, during cross-examination of every defense witness, and during closing arguments. I agree with respondent that the modified plain error test applies in this situation, given that the majority of the conduct was not objected to by trial counsel. That test requires that the defendant first establish the existence of an error that was plain. A plain error is an error that contravenes case law. State versus Porter is the case, one case that was contravened by this conduct.
I need some clarification. So you are focusing your arguments on the second issue, that the rulings collectively deprive your client of a fair trial.
That's correct.
Is that right? And you said that you're going to start by focusing on prosecutorial misconduct?
Yes.
I'm just looking at the table of contents of your brief, and I'm trying to see where that was briefed.
In the prosecutorial misconduct, Your Honor?
Yeah.
It was in both our principal brief and our reply brief. If you give me one moment.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I believe respondent also spent a significant amount of time combating that.
To be little I, it's not a separate header.
Thank you.
Little page I. Five of the reply.
I got.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem.
I'm sorry.
Not a problem, Your Honor. As I mentioned, the case law that has been contravened by the conduct at issue here was State versus Porter, specifically the requirement that, quote, the prosecutor must refrain from making statements that will inflame the passions of the jury. And here, the entire tenor of the prosecution of Mr. Gonzalez was infantilize the victims, demonize the defendant, and protect the children.
So is it prosecutorial misconduct if the judge overrules an objection and permits, isn't that judicial error, not prosecutorial misconduct? I'm trying to, because the judge allowed the prosecutor to do that, right?
Yes. Your Honor, where there's no objection, it's not plain error review, it's the modified plain error test that applies. So it's still the defendant's burden to establish that there was error that was plain, but it's not like this court lacks authority to remedy error if a judge fails to do so themselves at the district court level. I believe that's the purpose of the modified plain error test in the first place.
So the alleged prosecutorial misconduct here is referring to the two victims who were then adults at the time of the trial as little girls or little gals at the time of the charged incident.
Yes, Your Honor.
And asking the jury at the conclusion of closing argument, you know, what are you going to do about this?
Generally speaking, yes, Your Honor, that is.
Your argument is that that violates case law, saying you can't appeal to the passions of the jury.
Yes.
Okay. And I think there is one case that talks about, or maybe a couple, that a prosecutor can't argue, you know, you need to do something here to protect kids from abuse. Are you suggesting that? So that last line falls into that category.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Do we have any case law that says that last line, it was clear error?
Your Honor, I believe we cite cases in our brief that do address, and I believe you referenced them, cases that hold that the prosecutor is not allowed to argue that the jury is supposed to do something about the harm that is caused to these children.
But the case law talks about, you know, you don't allow the prosecutor to argue about doing things, you know, big picture, societal. This is a problem. We need to stop this. You need to do something, as opposed to, well, you've heard all the evidence in this case, now what are you going to do with that evidence? Find him guilty or not guilty? So isn't that a little bit different?
I would agree if the conduct here wasn't so invasive that it occurred at every step of the trial. I mean, these girls from the get-go are called three little girls. They're referred to by their nicknames as opposed to their real names. We're talking about Nanny. We're talking about Little Mimi.
But all without objection.
Primarily without objection, Your Honor. And I agree. I don't know why the defense attorney who represented Mr. Gonzalez during trial did not object to that. But I think the court itself retains an obligation when you see conduct like this to at least inquire of the parties, why are we calling them Mimi? Why are we calling these little girls Nanny?
Well, the other side of that coin is, well, maybe it doesn't hurt the defense to have them called little girls because maybe that just sort of emphasizes that there was a delayed report. Maybe they don't remember. They were little girls. I mean, it could have been a strategic decision from a defense attorney.
It could have been a strategic decision, Your Honor, and we're not claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. But when we're talking about the age of the victims at the time that this happened, even the respondent in their brief concedes that age was never disputed between the parties. On page 29 of their brief, they say age was not in dispute.
But I agree with that. But is age an element of the offense?
Age is an element of the defense. Youth is not. Being a little girl is not an element of the
defense. How did this, if we were to conclude there were error and that it was plain, how did this substantially affect your client's rights? Why would why would omission of those references have resulted in a not guilty verdict here?
Because of the nature of calling the alleged victims little girls and infantilizing them, making them seem vulnerable to a jury, it makes it less about the conduct that occurred and more about demonizing the defendant.
I thought I read somewhere in the briefs that these alleged victims were 17 and 19 at the time of trial?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, doesn't that kind of mitigate against this whole sympathy for children argument? I mean, we didn't have young children, little girls, testifying that might inflame the juries. You had an adult and a 17-year-old testifying about what happened to them many years ago. It seems different than having a 10 or 10-year-old out where they're trying to engage the jury in feeling sorry for them as children. These weren't children anymore. They were talking about something that happened to them many years ago, and the jury believed them. How would there be prejudice based upon what you're arguing here?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is, if they're 17 and 19, why didn't you just call them by their real names? Why didn't we just call them by their real names? Why do we need to refer to them as Nanny and Mimi? The second is that there were pictures introduced of them at the time that this happened through Fred Marie, the ex-wife and the biological mother. Mm-hmm. And while that evidence was being introduced to the jury, the prosecutor continued to refer to them as little girls. I believe JB was referred to as the little gal with glasses. Why do that? There's no need to do that other than to inflame the passions of the jury.
Counsel, I don't think you addressed in your briefing the fourth prong of the plain error standard or the modified plain error standard. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has recently emphasized the importance of that factor. And that is, even if there is error that's plain that affected substantial rights, court need not grant relief unless the error would cause the public to seriously question the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial system. Do we really think that referring to witnesses who were victimized as children as little gals in a trial and making the statement, what are you going to do with the evidence, is going to cause the public to question the fairness of the judicial system?
I think it does draw into question the integrity of the proceedings, Your Honor, because we are not talking about testimony where there is a little girl on the stand testifying and you're trying to be sympathetic and you're trying not to further traumatize them. You have a person who is 19 years old, 17 years old, who allegedly went through something horrific earlier in their life, but now they're sitting in open court being referred to as a nickname they had when they were 7 or 8 years old. Nanny and Mimi and the little girls. That is prejudicial conduct. And I do think that given the choice between calling them by their real names or calling them by childhood nicknames, the public would question why we are calling 17 and 19-year-old girls Little Mimi and Little Nanny while they testify about being sexually abused. Why aren't we treating them as a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old? There's no reason to do that, and the judge should have involved themselves in saying, hey, we're going to put an end to this. There was no objection. I don't know why the defense attorney did not object, but we're not going to allow that to occur because it does draw into question the integrity of the proceedings. With regard to the third element, Your Honors, that the burden shifts to the state to establish that Mr. Gonzalez's substantial rights were not impacted, I have two cases that I'd like to quote, and then I'd like to discuss Mayhorn because I believe the conduct at issue in the Mayhorn case is similar to that occurred here. The first is a quote from Porter that a prosecutor may not seek a conviction at any price. That's well established. But even 10 years before that, in State versus Danielson, this court stated prosecutors in sexual abuse cases must abide by the highest behavior. Calling an alleged victim Little Mimi and Little Nanny is not abiding by the highest behavior because there's no need to do it. It is only intended to draw at the heartstrings of the jury, to tug on their emotions, and to try to garner sympathy, and it worked. In Mayhorn, the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed on the basis of prosecutorial misconduct, and at issue there was essentially the defendant's propensity for anger and violence and aggression and control. It sounds very similar to what happened in this case with the holes in the walls, the deactivation of the phone, the just general anger. Fred Marie testified that he was angry every day. They would fight every day. There was lots of abuse in the home. And what the prosecutor did is they took that anger and control and the aggression and that testimony, and then they tailored it toward protecting these little girls because now he's controlling and being aggressive toward these little girls who he's abusing. So it's very similar to the Mayhorn case in that the prosecutor used the anger and aggression to tailor it toward further drawing on the heartstrings of the jury. And I think that makes it worse. I think it makes it worse when a prosecutor both attacks somebody's aggression and anger and desire to control, and then you say, oh, you're sleeping in bed with these little girls. Why would that man be sleeping in bed with these little girls? That's urging the jury to do something. That's urging the jury to protect the vulnerability of the victims, to do something about these poor little girls who can't defend themselves, so you, the jury, you need to. That's not proper. That's improper. That's prosecutorial misconduct. And seeing a conviction achieved, getting back to the fourth element, seeing a conviction attained on that basis does draw into question the validity of the verdict because it was obtained by using tactics that should be deemed improper by this court. You shouldn't be allowed to say, we have the right to a fair trial, but we get to call the victims nicknames that are intended to draw on the heartstrings of the juries. We get to refer to the alleged victims as little girls, as girls who were pretty little, as pretty little girls. That has no place in a trial like this, especially given the guidance that prosecutors in sexual abuse cases must abide the highest behavior. That's mandatory language. They must. I believe that, I don't believe. In State versus Porter, getting to, I guess, the third element of the modified plain error doctrine, this court, even if there's error, even if it's plain, won't reverse unless there is evidence that the defendant was denied a fair trial. Here, taking the prosecutorial misconduct along with the evidence of flight being admitted, the contents of the Snapchat video being excluded, the abortion evidence being excluded, the discipline of NG at school being excluded, the DNA test evidence being excluded, Fred Marie physically assaulting the new wife being excluded, Rebecca Dunn's evidence being excluded, all of that together serves to deprive him of a fair trial. And the reason for that is because he was not permitted to meaningfully defend himself. He had a theory of defense he was not permitted to meaningfully raise. And it was something that was supported by actual evidence. It wasn't just, I didn't do it, you don't have proof. It was, I have evidence of motive that this is fabricated, and he was not allowed to raise that. So I believe he was denied a fair trial. I believe those rulings in conjunction with the prosecutorial misconduct also served to draw into serious question the integrity of the proceedings. And I would ask this court to reverse and remand.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. I will largely defer to the briefing unless the court has any specific questions on any specific issues. But there are essentially two categories of errors being raised on appeal. The first is in regards to the parity issue, which has radically changed with Hope Coalition. I'll defer to the briefs on that. The second is this slew of trial errors raised by appellant on appeal, claiming now that if you add all this stuff up together, I was deprived of fair trial. Now, most of it was never raised below, and most of it is completely harmless, and none of it was actually error. So, first of all, I would turn to things like the speculation objection, number 8. There was no offer of proof. There was no other explanation for why they needed that evidence. That's forfeited and waived under this court's ruling. The defendant was represented at trial by a highly experienced criminal defense attorney. They're not claiming to have received ineffective assistance of counsel. They're just raising different issues that they would have raised, apparently, had they been trial counsel. But they weren't. Evidence of the Snapchat video. They're claiming on appeal one thing. They argued at the district court something else. I point the district court record out to this court in my brief, where the district court record is that they weren't going to admit the Snapchat video. They hadn't even seen the Snapchat video. So to claim now on appeal that they really, that's what's prejudicial, is not supported by the record. The discipline at school, same thing, district court level. They agreed, we don't want to put in evidence that makes NG look bad, because that's frankly a friendly witness for us. That's our only friendly witness. We don't want to put in any evidence that besmirches her. And I cite to the record in my brief on that. Same with attacking San Juanita on years before the reported assaults. They, in the district court level, agreed, yeah, that's not real direct evidence. It's pretty attenuated. But it sort of gives a flavor. That's why we want it. The district court certainly didn't abuse its discretion by excluding it. Spiegel evidence, same thing. Then we get to this little girls and small girls objection. First of all, I say objection. There was no objection. There was no objection to any of it. And in fact, the defense counsel referred to them the same way. This was a case where many of the witnesses had similar names, many of the witnesses were related, and many of the witnesses were now years older than when the events happened. So the parties used these references to sort of differentiate between at the time of the offense and at the time of trial. So they used their name largely at the time of trial, and then they used references otherwise to refer to it previously. But there was no objection, so presumptively there was no prejudice, certainly not seen by this experienced criminal defense attorney at trial. And under the plain error doctrine, which I lay out extensively in my brief, number one, plain error review is not guaranteed, so they should just simply have waived this issue. That's what this court should find primarily. And even if you look at footnote 7 of their brief, they raise even more things that they claim is plain error. The district court telling one of the witnesses that her name was pretty, but we wouldn't be using it anymore because we're going to refer to her by this name. The prosecutor asking a witness if she was okay to continue. There was no objection because this was no error. And when Judge Larkin asked, is there a case that says this is error? No, there is not. Refer to any of the cases that appellant directs you to, and you will see that the conduct in this case was not prosecutorial misconduct at all. So there was no error, there was no plain error, there was no prejudice, and they certainly fail on that fourth plain error factor as well. If the court has any questions on any particular issue, I will happily address that. Otherwise, I would simply rely on my brief and ask this court to affirm.
I don't see any questions, so appreciate your argument, and we'll just hear rebuttal argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just one point to respond to. The cases in response to that last point are Duncan, which is 608 Northwest 2nd at 556, where the prosecutor calling the defendant a predator was error. That was error that applied. That is the exact same implication of having an old man sleep in a bed with pretty young little girls, which is what occurred here. The implication is that he's being a predator. It's demonizing the defendant. It's infantilizing the victims. That's Duncan. State versus McNeil is another, cited in our reply brief at page 7. There, the prosecutor, conducting misconduct, stated her first sexual experience, not as an adult, not on her wedding night, not in college, not even in high school, as an 8-year-old, as a 9-year-old, as a 10-year-old, you can't give her back her childhood, you can't give her back her virginity. Same tenor as what was going on here. You're dealing with young girls who are victimized, who are vulnerable, who can't defend themselves, so you need to do it yourself, jury.
You know, frankly, I think there is some merit to your argument, but the problem is there was no objection. So you need to come to us with a case that says, plainly, clearly, this was not allowed. I mean, the argument that, well, this sort of looks like these other things that are inappropriate, there's merit there, but it's a high hurdle when you're dealing with the plain error standard.
Mayhorn, there was no objection, Your Honor, and Mayhorn was reversed.
But Mayhorn, the defendant was called a predator.
No, that was Duncan, Your Honor. Mayhorn was, I believe it was a murder case.
Okay.
But that was the case I referenced where the prosecutor engaged in misconduct by drawing undue attention to the aggression, the control, the violence. Here, that same thing happened. There's emphasis on, with almost every single state witness that was called.
Control, misconduct argument in your briefing really just goes to calling the victims little girls and asking the jury what they're going to do with it now that they have the case.
We also cite numerous errors, other errors that occurred at trial, including all of this evidence about the hole punching in the wall, the deactivation of the phone.
But you don't make that out to be a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. I mean, granted, you say, okay, there was all this testimony about punching holes in walls, being controlling, we should have been allowed to present evidence that, you know, here's what was on the Snapchat video, it was a reasonable decision to take the phone, here's why he punched a hole in the wall in this one time, it explains his action. That's not a prosecutorial misconduct argument.
Your Honor, my reading of the prosecutorial misconduct case law says that this court needs to look at the trial as a whole. You can't look in isolation. That's why there have been...
No, but you need to assign error to particular allegations of prosecutorial misconduct so we can evaluate them and so the other side knows what it's up against and can brief the issue.
And
I'm just expressing concern that you're expanding your prosecutorial misconduct argument to encompass these other alleged evidentiary errors, and you haven't done that in your brief, which puts everyone at a disadvantage.
And I will be clear, I believe that the prosecutorial misconduct was the reference to the little girls as little Mimi, as pretty young girls. I believe that is the misconduct, that is what's identified.
That's how I understood it from
yes.
your briefing. Okay.
The context, however, is what I'm arguing. The context of those statements given the other things that occurred at trial.
Understood.
If there are no other questions, I would see the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. And that concludes the court's hearings this morning. So we will retire to our deliberations. Thank you.